The following may contain offensive language, adult humor, and or content that some viewers may find offensive. The views and opinions expressed by any one speaker does not explicitly or necessarily reflect or represent those of Mark Rattledge or W2M Network. Please listen with caution, or don't listen at all.
There'll be spectacle, there'll be fantasy, there'll be daring do and stuff like you would never see.
Hey, a movie!
Yeah, we're gonna be a movie!
Starring everybody
and me. There'll be heroes bold, there'll be comedy, and a lot of fuss that ends for us real happily.
Hey, a movie!
We can watch it all develop.
Starring everybody
and me. We'll take the world. Set it on its ear.
Come on, join in. We're gonna start right here.
And we are gonna start right here. Hello and welcome to a Rattledge Broadcasting premiere podcast triple feature. I am your host, the man, data reporter, and frankly, I'm mortified, Mr. Mark Rattledge. And joining me tonight is your private dancer. He dances for money. Any old feature will do. But ladies and gentlemen, Whitney Houston. Welcome to the show, Whitney.
It's Whitey Houston. I'm Whitey Houston.
Oh, there's no, that's right. There's no end there. Hello, Whitey.
It's Whitey Houston. And when you think Black history here on the Rattledge Broadcasting Network, who else do you think of than me?
Listen, we are, that's right. Black History Month rolls on. Black Lives Matter. And we are celebrating Black cinema all month long here in the month of February, the year of our Lord 2024. So, and who better to do that with than ally of the Black community, Jason Teasley? How you doing, sir?
Doing good. After the day I've had, this is a welcome thing, though. This is 8 hours of my life that I'll never get back after watching these three movies, but we'll dive into that a little bit further.
I'll tell you what, I've watched a lot of combat sports in my time, and I haven't seen three better fights than the ones we're going to see. And What's Love Got to Do with It? Whitney Houston, I Want to Dance with Somebody, and Respect. These are fucking, like, you know, it's funny. Yeah, I've been making the joke internally all day. We joked about this previously when we talked about this podcast. I mean, this is actually the first one that we planned for this year's Black History Month. This was the first one we put together. And I said, hey, what's Love Got to Do with It? Whitney Houston, I Want to Dance with Somebody, and Respect all have in common? Domestic violence.
Yeah, that was the joke that we made. How the underlying thread that these had, not three predominantly strong Black women in the music industry, it was domestic violence.
Yeah, it is amazing how similar the stories are here. I mean, like, we're making light of a very serious subject, but when you think about Tina Turner from What's Love Got to Do with It, played by Angela Bassett, Whitney Houston, I Want to Dance with Somebody, starring Naomi Ackie as the titular Whitney Houston, and then Jennifer Hudson as Aretha Franklin in Respect. They all came out of the church. You know, they all kind of had a just let me sing the things I want to sing and I will be the most famous person ever. I mean, when you think about all three of these women, I mean, you and I are pretty close in the same age, and you couldn't get away from Tina Turner, Whitney Houston, and Aretha Franklin at any point in my nigh on almost 50 years of life. I mean, we're going to talk about each one in turn, but just in general, sort of kicking things off, you know, starting with Tina Turner, I never knew much of the Ike and Tina stuff because it was well before my time. But when she was coming on as a solo artist, I was born, I was young, you know, I remember What's Love Got to Do with It. Like, that was on the radio all the time that my parents would listen to. I remember Private Dancer, Dances for Money. I remember it very well, as a matter of fact. But, yeah. You know, even going back, I never saw until much later in life, The Road Warrior or Mad Max. Like, I don't think I saw Mad Max until Sean and I reviewed it for Long Road to Ruin. But the very first Mad Max movie I saw was Beyond Thunderdome. And of course, we all know what came out of that. Tina Turner's We Don't Need Another Hero, Thunderdome. Like, that song was everywhere. In my parents' record collection, you know, they referred to her as like the pop princess, Whitney Houston. Like, just growing up as a kid, Whitney Houston was as, you know, was as visible as the Beatles or Elvis in my house, in my home. Like, any, when my parents put on music in the house, there was a lot of 50s, a lot of 60s, a lot of doo-wop, but there was also a lot of soul and rhythm and blues, and Whitney Houston was right there. Like, you know, I've had I've had the song I Want to Dance with Somebody stuck in my head since I saw the movie.
Oh yeah.
That, you know, I Will Always Love You. I think that's the one people like maybe now remember her for because of The Bodyguard.
Whitney Houston, I'm more familiar with because, I mean, there's a plethora of Whitney Houston songs. Tina Turner, I was actually introduced to Tina through Tina Turner through Mad Max through the movie, and then I knew her film career, her music career through, like, you know, The Best, What's Love Got to Do with It, Don't Need Another Hero, Private Dancer, and Don't Want to Lose You. I mean, those are the songs that I had. Now, Whitney Houston, you know, that was pretty much one of her and Janet Jackson.
Yeah.
Some of the songs.
It's so funny. But you talked about at the very beginning of my cousin's Dionne Warwick. We had Dionne Warwick albums in my house. You know?
Yeah, well, I mean, me and you, I mean, we pretty much, I remember Dionne Warwick more for the late night infomercial.
Yes. We actually listened to her music. Yeah, you couldn't get away from Whitney Houston as a kid. She was
fucking
everywhere. She was like pervasive in the culture. But it was kind of a thing because, like, we didn't have the internet back then. Like, we're talking about the 80s now. So the Ike and Tina stuff was in the news, you know. And by the time she becomes a solo artist, it's well known that Ike beat the living shit out of her. All the things that happened to her, which was a crying shame. And as much as we kind of make light of stuff like that because we're weirdos, it's a horrible thing that happened to Tina. But, you know, again, once she becomes a solo artist, like, that's what we paid attention to. But, like, you didn't know about any of the behind the scenes stuff with Whitney until she and Bobby Brown went a little crazy. And it's weird because, like, when I think back to being a kid and listening to Whitney Houston's music, like, there's two distinct eras of Whitney Houston. There's the pop princess era, where she could do no wrong and everything she touched turned to gold. And then there's the, like, post Bobby Brown era, where it's
the downfall.
Yeah, it stopped being about her music, and it kind of became the Whitney and Bobby Clown show. You know, they're either smoking crack or he was beating her, and that was all you knew. You know, like, it was one of those things where the media treated her so shabbily. Like, this is a woman who clearly was in crisis, and we'll talk about that when we get to the movie. This is a woman that was clearly in crisis, clearly needing help, and Bobby Brown was kind of a monster, and the media just treated them both like jokes. And this was a woman that, you know, sold out arenas, that was, you know, treasured by, you know, white middle-class fans everywhere. And then it was like, oh, but, you know, she starts doing crack and getting beaten up by Bobby Brown. That's not like for help. She's just an asshole. Fuck Whitney Houston. Like, can very distinctly remember that being more or less the opinion of most people. And then you watch the movie, which we're going to talk about in a moment. And you described it in our pre-show chat as a little sanitized, but I to this day still feel bad for Whitney for everything she went through. Aretha Franklin, my most resounding memory of Aretha Franklin. Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to WrestleMania, and now to sing Spangled Banner, the Queen of Soul, Aretha Franklin. I didn't know much about Aretha Franklin. I just know her music was everywhere. You could not, as a kid in the 80s, you could not get away from Aretha Franklin. She was as much a part of the American culture as like I said, as the Beatles or Elvis. And it was like more so than Whitney Houston, who felt a little bit more contemporary, and even a little less so Tina Turner. Aretha Franklin always felt like my parents' music. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
It's like Aretha was like legit, like old people listen to.
Yeah, and what's funny about that is when mm-hmm. we was, we you know we say that as our parents' music. What Aretha was to us is like what you know Whitney Houston would be to our kids now.
And for sure.
That I mean, just in that time period, because I mean, you think about it. I mean, well, actually, not even that. I mean, if you look at that, that would be like Britney Spears would be to us. I mean, the early 2000s.
Right.
And I mean, that, I mean, that's crazy to think about because I mean, in the 80s, cause Aretha was like in the early, in like the 60s or I mean, you're thinking, you're looking at like early 2000s for us, mm-hmm. Which would be like, you know, your Christina Aguilera's, your, Brandy, Monica, Britney right. Spears, Missy Elliott. Even.
So I went to take my kids to McDonald's tonight. We were waiting for them to bring out the food because the lobby was under construction. And my son said something and it triggered because I'm like a human jukebox. So if you say something, it's like putting a quarter in my brain and out spits a random song. And he said something to me and I went at the playground. You know, Jason, playground.
ABC.
BBD.
Another bad creation.
Word. So I had I had fucking Another Bad Creation going in the car, playground. Which to this day, my funny memory of that is my very white Jewish cousin just blurting out, "We play Nintendo," because she fucking hated the song. I don't know if she can remember. but like I think I like a little ways back, like beginning of the year, I went to Saved by the 90s. I talked about this on the Metal Hammer of Doom. And they were playing like Belle Biv DeVoe and shit. Belle Biv DeVoe. Now you know. Yo, story. Jason.
Yes.
Blow. He's driving me out of my. Anyway, the vocal stylings of soul creator Mark Rutledge. But yeah, back then that was modern music. You know, Belle Biv DeVoe, Another Bad Creation.
Boys
New
to Men.
Boys to Men.
New Edition.
Right. And like Aretha Franklin was, you know, old people music. You know, yeah. I had also no idea that she was such an activist with like it's just again, I'm not with all three of these women. I didn't know really anything about their personal lives until I watched these movies that are also kind of like the greatest hits moments of these people's lives. You know, they just kind of touch on things, and it's one of the craft criticisms I actually have of all three of these. So like I just knew Aretha Franklin's music. I knew she sang at WrestleMania 3. I knew she was like in contemporary modern culture, but she was an elder statesman, and I never thought much about her until Jennifer Hudson's Respect movie came out. And this is the second time I've watched that, actually. I watched it. It didn't last long in theaters. And I watched it, I think, when it went to PVOD, and then promptly forgot all about it. And then watched it again for this review.
Yeah, and I will say this. You get the gambit of performances here too. Jennifer Hudson is a great actress, with an amazing mm-hmm. voice.
Oh, yeah, she does a kick-ass job as Aretha in Respect.
Angela Bassett is phenomenal in anything she
first of all
in.
Angela Bassett's fucking arms, we talked about this before. She's got like bigger, more defined arms than some wrestlers I know.
Incredible. But like Jennifer Hudson is the complete package. Angela Bassett is a great actress who admittedly can't sing worth a lick, so you get Tina Turner actually dubbed singing all the songs.
Okay.
The Whitney Houston movie is basically every note sang in that is actually Whitney Houston. Okay. And it's actually from the the moments of that, and that was because they didn't want to tarnish Whitney Houston's legacy in singing and performances. And it's,
you know, what are you going to do when you're talking about doing a biopic of someone who's referred to as the voice? The voice.
Right. But in the case of Tina Turner wanted Angela Bassett to sing, and Angela Bassett said, no, I cannot do you justice. And Tina Turner was like, okay, well, I want you to do this. She handpicked Angela Bassett to play her because there was a lot of people. Whitney Houston was actually up for the role to play Tina Turner in this movie. So was Janet Jackson. And there was a few other people that was up for it. But Tina Turner was like, no, when she seen Angela Bassett, she said, yes, that's who I want to portray me, which is a huge honor in itself.
Yeah.
And Tina Turner was like, okay, I will just dub over and you will just lip sync if you're okay with that. And Angela Bassett was like, yes, I could do everything but sync. And right. That was kind of a joke between them, that, you know, she's like, you got all my mannerisms down and everything. She's like, and Angela Bass was like, yeah, but I could not do you justice by even trying to sing your songs.
That's the other thing. The other thing that connects these three movies, and we really should get into them individually, Tina Turner, a little less so, but definitely Whitney Houston and definitely Aretha Franklin. Once-in-a-lifetime talents in terms of singing quality. I mean, they have good looks and stage presence and shapely bodies and all of that. They are all three the complete package. But, I mean, who the fuck sounds like Whitney Houston? There's a reason why she's called, like, and like, what actress are you going to get? You know, maybe the kid that played The Little Mermaid, but, you know, outside of that, like, not a whole lot of girls looking like Whitney Houston that sound like Whitney Houston. That can, you know, helm a feature-length motion picture. And then you have Aretha Franklin. It's like, again, once-in-a-lifetime talent. There's a reason why she was named the Queen of Soul and all of that. You know, this is not, you know, Jennifer Hudson. They're lucky they got Jennifer Hudson. And Jennifer Hudson could pull it off. But that is, like, the stars aligning.
Yeah, and, like, and there's a lot of synergy that goes back to Jennifer Hudson playing that.
Mm-hmm.
And we'll go into that a little bit more when we break down the craft and everything.
All right, so let's get into Whitney Houston, I Want to Dance with Somebody. And my first criticism about this movie is you didn't need to include the Whitney Houston part. Just, I Want to Dance with Somebody would have been fine. But this is a 2022 American biographical music drama film directed by Kazi Lemons. Kazi Lemons, you might know from her, she directed an episode of Women of the Movement. She directed Harriet in 2019, which nobody saw, but it was pretty good. Black Nativity, she directed Talk to Me in 2007. The Caveman's Valentine, and here's one you may have heard from way back in 1997, Eve's Bayou. She's also an actress. You may have seen her in some recent things as Disconnect from 2012 or Waist Deep, an episode of ER, etc. It's from a screenplay from Anthony McCartan, and it's based on the life and career of American singer and actress Whitney Houston. Stars Naomi Ackie, Stanley Tucci, Ashton Sanders, Wu-Tang. Yes, he plays the RZA in Wu-Tang and American Saga, and he is fantastic. He plays Bobby Brown in the movie. Tamara Tooney, Nafessa Williams, and Clark Peters in supporting roles. Clark Peters from The Wire. It was produced on a $45 million budget. Filming took place in Massachusetts and New Jersey between August and December of 2021. It was released December 23rd, 2022 by Sony. It received mixed reviews from critics and grossed about $60 million. So it lost money. It was not profitable. But that's all right. What is there to say in terms of plot? We meet her when she's like a late teen, like early adulthood, and she wants to be a big famous singer. Her mom's a singer. Her dad's a manager, played by Clark Peters. And you know, Whitney's whole thing is she just wants to sing. She's a naturally talented, God-given gift, and she just wants to sing, and she doesn't really want to put the work in. And the mom is like, no, you know, hard work pays off. Razor Ramon said so. And so there's some, you know, tension and dramatic struggle right there. As, you know, the parents are like, you have to put the work in, Whitney. And Whitney's like, I'm good. And I'm telling them just the way I am. So leave me alone. She catches the eye early on of Stanley Tucci, who's like, all right, you know, what do you want to sing? And we hear Whitney talk about, I want to sing big songs. And so they do. They go about creating big songs for Whitney to maximize her vocal talents. And that's where we get some of the early hits from her. Over the course of the movie, her image is shaped, her presentation is shaped, and so that she is utterly inoffensive and unthreatening to large white audiences far and wide, which makes her like a zillionaire. But she feels a little lost. A little bit of her soul she's sacrificing for the greater glory of, you know, fame and fortune. And so therein lies the part of the struggle with her, is deep down inside, she's just a girl from, you know, from the Jecks of Jersey. But she has to project this image of non-threatening, pretty, you know, black gal for white audiences. And it's a rough go. You know, imagine having to always have your face on, lest you lose everything. Could be nerve-wracking, so definitely fucked with her mental health, and we see that over the course of the film. She's also gay, and it's the 80s, and we don't take time, and in America in the 80s, as Jason will tell you, we don't take kindly to queers. So there's a lot of like, you can't be gay in public, Whitney. Get yourself a man. No one cares what you do behind closed doors. Have all the lesbians you want, but you know, when you're out in public, it's all penis all the time, which is part of the dramatic tension of the movie. She's struggling with that, as, you know, her creative director is also her partner, her romantic partner. And she's like, we're gay, the fuck. And Clark Peters, her dad, is like, yes, but you're also famous and it's the 80s. So no being gay in public, Sparky.
You got, and it's branding.
Yeah. Then she meets Bobby Brown look, I wasn't the world's biggest fan of Bobby Brown, but one of the things this movie does very effectively is show her getting all hot and bothered by early awesome Bobby Brown. Like, it's very clear why she had the meat sweats from him. So
the vapors,
the vapors. Yeah, she definitely got the vapors. So yeah, her and Bobby hook up, and it's a torrid romance. And they don't show you a lot of the domestic violence that went down between Bobby and Whitney. They also don't show you a lot of the poor woman's crack use over time. What they do show you is her struggling mentally with all the various stresses of her life, not the least of which is Bobby Brown. And she cracks under the pressure. And eventually her career suffers for it. The movie ends with her performing where, Jason? What was the big performance there? It's like a Grammy party or something like that. When she does the medley.
I think it was at the Grammys.
Yeah, she performs a medley at the end of the movie. Apparently it was a very famous medley. And they show her dying in the bathtub. And then the movie kind of ends with this medley, so that she kind of ends on like a happy note, and you get to see Whitney in, or, you know, in her final glory. But again, by that point, she was no longer the Whitney Houston we all knew and love. I liked it. I was entertained by it. It's kind of my favorite of the three, probably because I like the music the most out of all three of these women. I think my criticisms sort of echo yours in that it just touches on a lot of the depravity and struggles that she had with Bobby Brown. And I feel like if you're going to do a movie like this, yes, you want to get into her creative process. Yes, you want to get into what made Whitney Whitney. Yes, you obviously have to touch on these various mental health stressors that she had in her life. But if we're going to do this, then let's do it. Let's get into the dirty nitty gritty. And they don't really do that. They fucking whitewash a lot of stuff here.
Yeah, like I told you, this was very sanitized. And you have a lot of this with biopics, postmortem, with a lot of famous people, you know, especially like Whitney Houston, Elvis. I'm surprised we haven't got a Kurt Cobain biopic that is very sanitized that makes Courtney Love.
But what are you going to do with what are you going to do with the Kurt Cobain biopic? You got to show him getting murdered.
Yeah, I mean, you know, that's why I said that makes Courtney Love look like rather than, you know, his killer. allegedly. But yeah, I mean, you see a lot of this postmortem because a narrative is given to the survivors. And nobody, it just goes back to the old saying that, you know, I live by there's three sides to every story. Yours isn't the truth, and you'll never see the truth. Right.
Let me jump in here real quick. So years ago, Jed and I from the Casual Heroes reviewed Straight Outta Compton, and it was produced and definitely influenced by the survivors of Eazy-E's estate and Ice Cube and Dr. Dre. And one of the criticisms that Jed gave of the movie was, yeah, Dre beat the shit out of a lot of women, and that's not in the movie.
Yeah.
Like, again, we get as best a light as you could paint on NWA and Eazy-E in particular. But it's like Dr. Dre also gets made to look halfway decent. And it's like, that's not really what happened. And it's just like, some of it, getting back to the Whitney Houston thing when comparing it to Straight Outta Compton, is what story you want to tell and how much creative licensing are you going to use to tell that story?
Yeah, because, I mean, Whitney was a crackhead. I mean, there's no easy way to say it. That's what led to her taking her own life, is she was a drug addict. And she was addicted to crack, partially because of what Bobby Brown put her through and what he subjected her to, and partially because of the fame that she had to endure and what was expected of her and everything. See, this happen with a lot of famous people. They have a drug addiction that becomes bigger than what they are and what they can handle, and it leads to their demise. It's a tragic story that we see with a lot of Hollywood, a lot of musicians, Hollywood types, that they do get addicted to drugs to handle the pressures of the fame and fortune, and it ended up being their downfall and, you know, cut life short. Most notably, you know, Heath Ledger. Heath Ledger was a drug addiction and an overdose cut his life short because committed, people say that, you know, it was the commitment to the role, and honestly I think it was a lot of that and the depression was suffering that nobody actually identified. He was very troubled and nobody recognized it, because mental health is a stigma that nobody likes to talk about. You know, you being a health professional, you can relate to that.
Yeah.
Even now, a lot of people don't like to talk about their mental health. They'd rather self-medicate than ask for help. And, you know, and being in the public eye, that happens more and more, and it's a highly kept secret. So
I think part of it is sanitizing. In Houston, is no one wants to say no to the Golden Goose. You know, Whitney had her own company. You know, Whitney's singing and acting is what kept everybody fed, which is actually a line from fucking Aretha Franklin in Respect, is I don't sing, you don't eat. And so nobody wants to say, like, if you have, you know, a friend or a family member and they're spiraling and your life doesn't really hinge on their failures or successes, you just care about them as a person, it's really easy to sort of get in there and be like, please stop. You're hurting yourself and everyone around you. This has to end. It is harder to do that when that person is
directly
a rich and famous, talented artist to where you're like, if I say no, I might get cut off. And there becomes a lot of like, do I risk getting excised from this family if I say no to this person? Also, you know, what do we have to do to keep this person singing? What do we have to do to keep this person acting, keep this person playing, doing whatever it is we need them to do? You know, it's like you're a sports person. How many times have you thought about, you know, you've heard stories, and I think we talked about this last year when we did the football triple feature before the Super Bowl, about coaches like, are you injured or are you hurt? You know, and how much drugs we have to pump into you to keep you playing.
Right. And, you know, and it goes back to, do you bite the hand that feeds you? You know, and everybody has their entourage. And a lot of people, and, you know, this is going to be kind of relevant here, with a lot of news that broke, and it's, and people can check this off bingo card. And, you know, with the news breaking in the wrestling world right now, have your inner circle, you're going to do whatever your boss tells you is providing you a steady income. You're going to be a yes man. You're going to, yes. And you're going to go with along with flow as long as you have a steady payday and you have nothing to worry about and you have job security and you have food putting on the table. You're going to sacrifice your morals and your morals and standards to make sure that you have a steady income. And that's what I think a lot of actors and famous people have, is they have this inner circle that will support them no matter what. And that's what we see. We see that across all three of these movies.
Right.
Is you have that.
The fact, look, it is criminal what happened. I don't want to, like, we'll get into it in just a few minutes, but it is criminal that anyone let what happened to Tina Turner happen. There were people in the room, you know, at least with like,
yes,
with like Aretha Franklin, like Tom was like beating her in private, you know, the stuff that happened with Whitney and Bobby, a lot of that happened in private. Like, there's rooms full of people when Ike is just wailing on Tina Turner and no one stops him. Not a single person.
And we're going to talk about that here shortly. But also with Bobby, his star power carry in this time was high as well. So you had people that would back him, that would collaborate his stories to discredit Whitney and her stories. So you had two megastars of the time with a he said, she said. And, you know, and it becomes a very toxic environment. And you had all these tabloids, but you can relate to this. You have toxic relationships where you stay with somebody through everything, through the toxicity, because you're scared to walk away, because you're scared of the unknown. And you just stay through the toxicity until it brings you to a point to where you're at rock bottom and you have no way to know how to get out of it.
All right, let's just wrap up. I want to dance with somebody real quick. I think Naomi Aki did a really good job as Whitney, sort of portraying that internal struggle between the two sides of her personality, you know, the ghetto Jersey girl and America's sanitized pop princess. And I think she captured the mental struggle that Whitney Houston went through pretty well. Ashton Saunders is a great actor. Again, highly recommend everyone go watch Wu-Tang and American Saga. He is awesome as LaRizza. He's in fucking rough company with Lawrence Fishburne as Ike Turner and Forest Whitaker as CL, whatever the hell his name is. We'll talk about it. And Marlon Wayans in the very same movie. Like, this is a group of fucking intimidating men, and Austin Sanders is not like a big dude. He's a little fella, but I think he does a really serviceable job here of coming across as menacing to Whitney. Like, there's a couple of scenes of him and the chick that plays Robin, and it never gets as bad as some of the Lawrence Fishburne stuff, you know, but which looks like a fucking MMA fight at times in What's Love Got to Do with It. But he's definitely intimidating in the movie. And there's a couple of scenes, a couple of interactions with him and Robin, where he looks like he's going to throw Robin through the window, out the window. So what I recommend, you know, it's on Netflix now. You can watch it for free. And if you're, you know, her music was some of the best I've ever heard. I love Whitney Houston's music. I love her voice. You know, one of the things that was nice about the movie was I think it did a really good job of framing those songs and giving me a greater appreciation for them and made me want to go back and listen to her music again. Like I said, I've had the song I Want to Dance with Somebody stuck in my head for the last couple of days since watching the movie. Your final word here on I Want to Dance with Somebody, the craft of it, whatever.
Definitely. It's serviceable. Like I said, it's very sanitized. But what I would say is if you really want to see a more closer representation, there's another biopic out there. Go watch it. If you want to see the absolute best Whitney Houston performance ever, definitely check out the 1991 Super Bowl National Anthem. Absolutely Whitney Houston's best performance ever. If that doesn't stir something in you, in your soul, you're dead inside. I think that is one of the absolute best versions of the National you can actually ever hear.
Hey, real quick, so
with that time frame.
So we're streaming live on Instagram right now, but the comments don't come through, just like on Twitter. So Pat joined in our Instagram show, and he left the following comments, and I feel bad I couldn't respond to him in time. But he goes, remember the time Whitney ruined Bobby Brown's life? And then he goes, Bobby was not the monster. Generally, everyone has acknowledged she was the abusive one who ruined him. Okay. I read these out loud, Pat. All right.
But yeah,
Pat,
definitely
Pat take in with, a look. Look, Pat in with a defense of fucking Bobby Brown.
Yeah.
All right.
Pat does love him some Bobby Brown. But definitely check out the Super Bowl performance of Whitney Houston. Look mm-hmm. at some of her live performances. Whitney Houston has an amazing voice. Look at her filmography. She has some very, very great hits.
Yeah, I remembered her from like The Bodyguard, but I fucking forgot that like she did a whole bunch of movies besides The Bodyguard, which I completely forgot about. She's
I just remember her.
She's in Waiting to Exhale. She's in Waiting to Exhale, The Preacher's Wife, the 1997 Cinderella, Sparkle, and then those were her features. So did a fair bit of acting there, Whitney Houston did. All right. Let's move on to What's Love Got to Do with It from 1993. It's a biographical film based on the life of American singer, songwriter Tina Turner. That's a bit of a misnomer. This is really about Ike and Tina. But it was directed by Brian Gibson and written by Kate Lanier from an uncredited story draft by the late Howard Ashman based on Tina's 1986 autobiography, I, Tina, which stars Angela Bassett as Tina and Lawrence Fishburne as the devil. I mean, Ike Turner. It premiered in Los Angeles on June 6, 1993. It was theatrically released by Touchstone, which I think was owned by Disney at the time, June 25th, 1993. Although the Turners disapproved of its inaccuracies, the film was critically and commercially successful, grossing $61 million on a $51 million budget. For their performances, Bassett and Fishburne received nominations at the 66th Academy Award for Best Actress and Best Actor. Bassett also won the Golden Globe for Best Actress, Motion Picture Comedy, or Musical. So Tina Turner's story, again, she grew up in Tennessee. Her sister is whisked away by a family member. Years later, Tina follows her to, I believe it's St. Louis. They start going to the old juke joints, clubs. They see Lawrence Fishburne's, Ike Turner's review, and a gimmick that they do is that they'll pass around the mic to various ladies who all want to sing in Ike's band. And they try. And, you know, there's a lot of this going on. Like, you're not really cutting it there, pretty gal. However, Tina, who already a singer from church and all of that, she's been practicing, and all she ever wanted to do was sing and dance. So she gets the microphone, and she captures the imagination of Ike Turner, who says, "Yes, you're the singer in the band now." And so they're off and running. It's the Ike and Tina show. They're doing standards. They're doing covers. They're doing a lot of stuff that Ike writes. And sooner than later, Ike becomes very abusive of Tina. And this is like the very model of a domestic violence abuse situation where like if you're looking for a step-by-step guide to abusing your spouse, this would be it. It's anytime she fucking mouthed off to him, and it's also like, if you want to see what narcissist personality disorder looks like, Ike Turner isolates her, beats her. She minimizes her voice, puts her down. There's a lot of, "You can't make it without me. What are you going to do? I do everything for you. You're useless," yada, yada, yada. And when that doesn't work, the first scene of him wailing on her, it's a pretty well shot scene. He knocks her down and you can't see him, but like Tito Ortiz would be proud of this ground and pound. He just stands over her and like this isn't like an open hand, like fucking calm down slap. He is standing over her, clenched fist, and just punching her dead up in her face and then dragging her by her hair and saying, "Stay in the room and don't come out," like she's a child. And it only gets worse from there. This man beats this woman on a fairly regular basis to the point where she is struggling. Ends up in the hospital a couple of times. I think she starts like a drug habit. There's a lot of issues there. And like the guys in Ike Turner's band that are around, because they have a recording studio in the house and they're there recording music, just watch it all happen. I was like, Ike's just got to teach Turner a lesson. Ike's got to teach Tina a lesson. This all comes to a head where they're at a hotel for one of their performances, and Ike falls asleep and she fucking makes a run for it. And probably the most powerful scene of the movie, short of anything involving a live beating, she goes to the hotel. She's like, with the grace and dignity of a woman who has just escaped hell, says to the very white hotel manager, "My name is Tina Turner. I'm performing next door. I need a room. I'll pay you back." And I know race relations are not great in this country, but in some of this, especially, back in when this was happening, was significantly worse than it is now. But the guy, just as portrayed in the movie at the very least, just kind of looks at it and goes, "We know who you are. We're huge fans. Go get her a room." And the next thing you know, she's divorcing Ike and a lot of people. Sometimes you just have to walk away and burn everything. And, much like The Crucible, just hold on, just hold on to your name. It's the only thing you've got. Which she does. She keeps the stage name Tina Turner in the divorce and gives everything else up. And Ike's like, "Fuck off. Like, you're never going to make it without me." And the next thing you know, she's, doing a lot of like hotel shows, and she's trying to get herself back together, and she catches the eye of a manager, and the manager's like, "What do you want to do?" And she's like, "I hear rock and roll's a thing." So they put together a band, and she starts doing rock and roll. Ike tries once or twice more times to, one, intimidate her with a gun, and like a lot of victims of long-time domestic abuse, they finally just say, "Fuck it, you're gonna kill me, but I'm not living in fear of you anymore." So strike one. And then he tries, later on, after she's successful, to corner her and be like, "Hey, I've changed. Baby, come back. You can blame it all on me. I was wrong, and I just can't live without you. And oh, by the way, I wrote these songs for you to sing." And she's like, "Yeah, too late. Too late. I'm not interested." And then, that's about the end of the movie. The post-title cards come up to basically say, like, he went to prison and she went on to entertain millions far and wide, being the icon Tina Turner. This movie deserves all the credit that it gets. It is fucking brutal at times. It's a hard watch, but Angela Bassett is phenomenal in this. And look, all the credit in the world to Lawrence Fishburne. You kids probably know him from the Zilly Matrix movies. You go, oh, look, it's Morbius. Or Mobius, whatever the fuck his name is. Doesn't matter. But Lawrence Fishburne can act. We talked about him last year when we discussed Boys in the Hood. Lawrence Fishburne has range. And I don't think he gets enough credit for it because, like I said, other than the Matrix movies, and by that point he was an elder statesman. He's not the star of that thing. Keanu Reeves is a star. But I don't think people realize how good Lawrence Fishburne really is. And he is one of the most intimidating villains of any story I've seen in a long time. Him as Ike Turner, I'm not kidding when I said, and I don't think I'm overstating it, he's the fucking devil. He is awful in this movie. And Lawrence Fishburne deserves all the credit he gets for really going for it and portraying Ike Turner as this awful, awful human being.
And what's really, you know, just some behind the scenes information about this, Fishburne actually turned the role down to play Ike Turner 5 times. The only time that he signed on to it, he didn't commit to the role until he found out that Angela Bassett was playing Tina Turner. And as soon as he found out that that was who was playing Tina Turner, that's when he finally committed to playing the role. As ironically, playing this role and playing it the way he did, it took him years upon years upon years before women would quit looking at him in disdain and disgust for his role as Ike Turner, because he played it so well. And they took it as him actually being Ike Turner and him being this absolute horrific human being that was a womanizing abuser. And there's certain things, roles that you just submerge yourself into, and to get that such a vitriol reaction from people.
Mm-hmm.
And Lawrence Fishburne he could be the nicest person, come off as the nicest person, but he has that very intimidating presence as well.
Have you ever seen him in Higher Learning where he's the professor? He's Ice Cube and Busta Rhymes' professor. Peppermint. It's my favorite line from the whole movie. What you doing over there? Plotting? Yeah. You're plotting to steal. Steal the knowledge.
Yeah. And and also, he actually sings all of Ike Turner's lines. All the singing done in there, all of the songs that is sung by Ike Turner is actually done by Fishburne, which is a testament to him as well. So this movie is something to be revered. This was actually what I told you, due to me getting a little sick, I got about three quarters of the way through. This was probably my favorite one of the three, because
it's definitely the best made.
One, I love Angela Bassett. There is nothing that I see her in that I do not love her in. Whether it's TV and 9-1-1, her portrayal in Black Panther, this. You know, she is a beautiful, amazing actress. She doesn't age. I swear she doesn't age. She looks better now. She looks better now than she does in this movie. And I'm pretty sure that she looks like she, these movies with, if you see her on 9-1-1 now and you go back and look at her, in this movie, it looks like they was probably filmed within a couple years apart because I mean, she is a beautiful, beautiful lady. And you know, like you said earlier, when we was talking, she has an amazing muscle tone. Like, she's got like a bodybuilder physique in this. She's got, very big defined arms in some of these shots, and it's like,
if you were given a choice, you can either take an ass whooping by Angela Bassett playing Tina Turner, or take an ass whooping by Lawrence Fishburne. I'll just throw myself out the fucking window.
Yeah, I mean, it's like one of those, you know, you're taking an ass whooping either way. I mean, it's just how, you know, it's one of those, are you going to take an ass whooping by 10,000 frogs or one gorilla? It's an ass whooping either way. It's just how long is the ass whooping going to last?
Right.
And it's, you know, like you said, if you talk about domestic violence in relationships, one couple that transcends everything is the Ike and Tina relationship. And in this time frame, domestic violence was not what we see it as today. And that's something that people don't understand. A lot of things get looked through in through the glasses of 2024, not the glasses of the time period that you're looking at. And that's through a lot of things now. People like to look back at the time period when something was said or something was done through the lenses of today. And and they criticized it for that. But at that time, it was a norm. Domestic violence was normal at one point.
Well, let me talk about that for a second, because like there's stuff with like Aretha Franklin where it's like you're being hysterical and they hit her, you know, like, which still is not what you should be doing. And I'm not defending it anyway, but there's that. There's, you know, the kind of stuff with like Bobby Brown and Whitney where like, again, they're just amped up and getting aggressive and you whack your partner, and none of it's forgivable, but at least, okay, I see where you're coming from there. What Lawrence Fishburne did to, or what Ike Turner rather did to Tina Turner, it goes beyond domestic violence. It was a battery, okay? This was a felonious battery on this woman, not to mention, and they only show it once, but I'm sure it happened more than once. There's an act of rape that goes on in this movie, where she's in the sound booth, and he clears everybody out of the room, and he just goes in there and like violently has sex with her, you know, while you know, throttling her throat. Like, if that's even remotely true, what a nightmare! And again, you know, to your point of like, listen. You know, every once in a while, you know, you slap your woman around because she, you know, because she's hysterical, she's out of line. You're just trying to, you know, maintain control. Yeah, none of that's good. But if we're looking on it with contemporary eyes for the time period, that's what they did, and nobody thought anything of it. Ike is worse than that, though. Ike is far worse than that.
Oh yeah, I mean, it's criminal what he does.
Yeah,
I mean, I'm not I'm not saying that, you know, what he does is acceptable. I'm just saying. Yeah. For the time period, nobody thought of it being unacceptable. Everybody, right. it wasn't frowned upon like it is today. It wasn't, you know, the man was an authoritarian figure if his woman got out of line. It was, quote unquote, expected to put her back in her place.
I think there's even a scene where, like, Tina Turner's talking to her aunt, and you know, and the aunt's like, don't nag him. It's like, you have a good man. Like, despite the fact that this man is raping and abusing you, never mind all that. The man earns money, and you know, and a man that earns money is hard to find these days. Back in, you know, the ye old days of the 60s and 70s, you know. Yeah, hey, keep your pimp hand strong.
Keep your pimp hand strong.
More on that in 2 weeks. So because it's hot out here for a pimp, Jason, you know that.
It is.
So my point is like. And I'm not saying that you were necessarily suggesting this, but I just want to make this clear for the listeners. Like, worse than anything in I Wanted to Dance with Somebody or Respect, the stuff that happens to Tina Turner is, I mean, you're a horror fan, you're a gore hound. You know, you like your Jason Voorhees's and your Michael Myers and your Freddy Krueger's. And I'm going to go ahead and make a bold statement. This might get me canceled. Ike Turner's worse. Ike Turner is a frightening individual, as portrayed in this movie, at least. By Lawrence Fishburne, he is a frightening, intimidating, violent, horrible monster.
Okay, I will say this. Ike Turner would fit in the gore porn, such as like Hostel and stuff, like the torture porn.
Yeah.
That's kind of what you would see Ike Turner falling into, that kind of horror genre of like the torture porn, because he got off on it.
Yeah. A couple more things just about the craft of this movie. It moves, I think of the three, it probably moves the best. You know, one of the things I have complained about with Respect is like, it's like an over an hour before she fucking becomes Aretha Franklin. It goes for like, it goes on forever. Whitney Houston becomes Whitney Houston pretty fast. So like no problem there, but there's like, it kind of meanders in the middle. This one, I feel like for even the length of the movie, you know, it moves at a pace, and when she finally breaks free from him, it's at the proper place in the movie, and it doesn't, in the third act of it, you know, where she's left the guy, like I said, there's the bit with the hotel where like, please give me a room, I'm running from a horror monster. And then, you know, the stuff with him coming, trying to come back for her and everything, and then her finally leaving him that one last time, and you know, and then he goes off into the distance to go to prison. That all moves pretty quickly. I think the performances are great. You know, the music, the thing with all three of these movies is that if you're not a fan of the music, though I can't imagine why you wouldn't be, but if you're not a fan of the music, these are hard watches by, you know, just because like so much. I'll tell you what, like one criticism I have by comparison, a lot of like the Whitney Houston stuff, once I kind of got my fill of the song, I had to kind of like skip 10 seconds. And part of it was I was in a rush to watch these for the show on a time crunch. But some of it was like also like, all right, I got it. I've heard you do The Greatest Love of All. Cool. Like I've heard you do I Want to Dance with Somebody. Right. I don't need the full fucking song. And half of like the runtime of Respect and I Want to Dance with Somebody is the full on version of these songs. To the point where I gotta kind of skip through them. What's Love Got to Do with It isn't quite as bad. Like, it moves pretty quickly, and the performances, the songs, I feel like more often than not you get a taste for it, but it's not a full-on, you know, Luke Cage concert every fucking 5 minutes. So, anything else about What's Love Got to Do with It?
The only thing I want to say here is if something that was included in the trailer that wasn't included in the movie that you touched on is when they are going through the divorce, you know, Tina Turner said that she will give up the name as long as she gets away from him. Right. And you know, that's saying a lot because, you know, branding. But yeah, she was so adamant to get away with him. She said she will sever ties with the name of Tina Turner and start being called whatever, just to get away from the monster that he was, to sever ties. And that says a lot, especially in the music industry.
Mm-hmm. Yep. All right. And then our final feature of the night is Respect, R-E-S-P-E-C-T, Find Out What It Means to Me. It's a 2021 American biographical musical drama directed by Liesl Tommy in her feature directorial debut. Written by Tracy Scott Wilson and Callie Curie. It's based on the life of the American singer Aretha Franklin, the Queen of Soul. Stars Jennifer Hudson as Aretha, Forest Whitaker, Marlon Wayans, Audra McDonald, Marc Maron, Titus Burgess, and Mary J. Blige in supporting roles. It follows the first three decades of Franklin's life, from being born as a musical prodigy in the affluent African-American family, the repercussions of losing her mother at the age of 10 to her arduous rise to international music stardom, during an abusive marriage, ultimately concluding with a recording of her influential live album Amazing Grace in 1972. After much delay and postponement due to the burgeoning COVID-19 pandemic, Respect premiered in Los Angeles on August 8th, 2021, and was released theatrically in the United States on August 13th of 2021 by United Artists Releasing and in other territories, Universal Pictures. Generally positive reviews from critics with praise for performances, the film's production values and costume design, but received criticism for its screenplay and long running time. Yeah, this thing clocked in at
almost 3 hours.
Almost, yeah, 145 minutes. It was made on a budget of $55 million. It also tanked, but then again, in the year of our Lord 2021, like, there was, So just real quick, to set the stage for this, August 21, there was a surge in COVID infections. So, like, people were not, they, I think there was a, what was it, the Omicron, oh gosh, what's the word they
use? The Decepticon.
Just shut up. It was the variant, the Omicron variant at the time. People just weren't going to the movies, you know. I remember doing Damn You Hollywood that month, and, you know, like, Suicide Squad came out. Suicide Squad was great, but between being Dane Date on HBO Max at the time, plus people just not wanting to go to the movie theaters and possibly die from COVID, like, no one went to the movie. So everything that came out in the month of August in 2021 fucking, you know, failed. Suicide Squad came out in July, by the way, but still, by August, people don't want to go to the movies anyway, let alone during, you know, a variant on a pandemic. So
that was fake.
Shut up. So like the plot says there, Forrest Whitaker plays C.L. Franklin, who's her father, and Marlon Wayans plays Ted White, her abusive husband and manager. We meet her as a kid. There's an allusion. They don't show it. But it's definitely alluded to that she was molested, which causes her to have, you know, as any child would, some pretty severe mental health issues. And then there's like a flash forward, like Jesus, like a whole bunch of her life just gone. We, you know, now she's an adult and she's under the watchful eye of her father, who's trying to get her into singing, and her father's picking all of her music. And it's really funny because, like, I don't want to necessarily bash the woman, but she's portrayed by Jennifer Hudson as almost a little vapid and shallow. You know, like, Aretha, what kind of music do you want to sing? I just want hits.
Yeah, okay. just hits.
Like, what does that mean? Like, what, Aretha, what kind of music do you, what style? What are you going to talk about? What do you want to sing to the world? What stories do you want to tell? I just want hits. One hits. Like, all right, no wonder you struggled in the beginning. But, you know, she finally breaks with her father and she gets with Marlon Wayans, and he has a different ear for music, but it also does not go well until she comes across Marc Maron, who gives her some guidance and gets her with some musicians. And I tell you, my favorite part of this entire movie is when she goes down to, I think it's Tennessee, and she's with the white band. And the one guy comes to see them later, and he's just there to tell them, like, they fired the trumpet player because he was a little handsy.
Oh, my God.
And he was like, you white, you redneck me one more time, and Marlon Wayans is not backing down. And I can't repeat a lot of what is said in that scene. Though, you know, a fan of racial slurs, it was a fun little moment between the white guy and the black guy in that scene. Then they get into a fist fight. But yeah, she finally starts getting some hits. You know, she records Respect, and of course that blows up, and she goes on tour, and it's, you know, and eventually she leaves Marlon Wayans. She ends up with the European tour manager. We are 2/3 of the way through this movie before Aretha Franklin starts to fucking fall apart. And that's when she at the end of the house, where she's just like, I don't, you know, they're like, every, you know, the tour manager, the booker, is like, you don't show up to half your dates because you're exhausted and you're not dependable. So maybe don't do all of them. Let's take a break here. Let's slow down. She's like, nope, I have to run from my drama. And eventually she collapses on stage, like you do, and she gets the help that she needs. And then she finds her way back to the church and she makes amends with her dad. She records Amazing Grace. It's a huge hit. I think it's like her biggest hit ever. And the movie ends. And, you know, we get a list of all of her achievements. She is one of the most celebrated artists in the history of America, most widely known and respected, among the most widely known and respected. She is not only the queen of soul, but a goddess among men in terms of art. And I think the movie did a fairly decent job of telling you that. So Jennifer Hudson, I think, does a pretty good job of being Aretha Franklin. You know, she, it's funny, kind of reminded me of like Whitney Houston's thing of there's who you are and then there's who you're trying to be and wherever the twain shall meet. And I think Jennifer Hudson did a really good job of trying to find that balance between those two sides of her. Marlon Wayans, you know, he ain't no Lawrence Fishburne, but he's pretty intimidating in this. He put on some fucking muscle for this thing. And, you know, he looked like, he looked like when he was done with Jennifer Hudson, he was going to go fight The Rock. He was looking pretty buff in this movie. Forest Whitaker's always good. He's looking Emmy in this one. But I think overall, respect for him.
The intimidation factor when he comes in after the mother dies and he tells a small child, "You're going to sing at church tomorrow." That's kind of fearful. Because if you ever been to a black church, that they depicted the black church very, very, very well. From the passionate preacher to the sternness of a passionate preacher, to the enthusiastic of the church and the soul that you get in the church and how it's portrayed. And I think that this movie could have lost about 45 minutes and still got its point across. I think it drug a lot and it hovered a lot in places where it shouldn't have. And you could have kind of glossed over some things, and implied some things rather than drag it out. This movie, it was really good. Jennifer Hudson does an amazing job. I love, these are the type of movies that she is built for. And maybe next year we could maybe throw on Dreamgirls, because that's a really good film to look at and dissect that she is phenomenal in. But, you know, that's a year away, and I know I don't want to fuck with your schedule too early. But, yeah, maybe we could throw that on next year, because that is a movie that she just thrives in and gave her a big break in movies and the musical aspect that shows her just how good of an actress and a singer she is. Also, it shows how good Jamie Foxx is actually an actor and shows his range. But this shows the rise and fall of a queen of the Motown era of music, that really brought a style of music to the forefront that wasn't there, because she was singing a lot of songs that were very sanitized, were very bland. And then she went kind of out on her own. And there was a lot of animosity about her going down to Alabama, singing with an all white band that they had zero to no faith in. And she found a rhythm with them that helped propel her into stardom. Not a lot of people knew that. And that was shown here, that, you know, you had a predominantly black singer in this era that was surrounded by a white musical band that helped launch her career in the South in the middle of, you know, the 60s and the civil rights movement.
Yeah. One thing I wanted to touch on before we close up shop is that the movie focuses a lot on her activism. I think there's an argument to be made of maybe more should have been made of this, but they spent so much time on everything else. We're at a 2.5 hour runtime. I certainly don't want it to be any longer than that, but some stuff I think could have been traded out, because they touch on her work. There's a scene in the movie, and because there's obviously a lot of focus on her development as an artist and on the domestic violence stuff. But there's a scene where, like, they get a phone call and they're like, "Martin's dead. He's been shot." And I'm like, "What character is Martin?" And it took me a minute. I'm like, "Oh, Martin Luther King."
Martin, which,
if you're going to include, yeah, yeah, if you're gonna do that in the movie, then a little bit more of her activism needed to be focused on, because I had forgotten that that was a thing in the movie. Then there's like another bit where they capture Angela Davis, and she makes a huge deal. The movie makes a huge deal about this, and you're just like, again, forcibly reminded that she was an activist when the movie doesn't bother to keep up with any of that stuff.
Yeah, the whole Martin Luther King thing. You see that he's at church when she's like a little girl.
Yeah,
and he's at church with her dad. Her dad introduces him at church, and then there's like nothing mentions about it until he's killed. And she goes to sing at the funeral. And what's really cool about that is, I don't know if you noticed this, how they spliced actual footage of her singing at Martin Luther King's funeral in with Jennifer Hudson.
Yeah.
Which I thought was really cool. You actually seen Aretha Franklin, some actual archive footage of Aretha Franklin singing at Martin Luther King Jr.'s funeral.
Anything else about Respect?
No. I mean, I'd recommend it just for the historical aspect of Aretha Franklin. If you want to, you know, get some background of someone, musical figure, of somebody that did sing for the African-American females that paved the way for people like Tina Turner and
Whitney Houston.
Yeah. Can you hear me?
While he sorts his internet out. Yeah, it was nominated and won a bunch of awards, not the least of which was here for Grammys. Oh, yeah. It was nominated for a Golden Globe. I saw Grammys in here. It was nominated for a bunch of People's Choice Awards. I mean, yeah, it was pretty well regarded in the year that it came out. Yeah, there it is. It was nominated for Best Compilation Soundtrack for Visual Media and Best Song Written for Visual Media at the Grammy Awards in 2022. All right. You were saying before we head out of here?
I was just saying that definitely, if you want to check it out for the way that she paved the way for, you know, Tina Turner and, you know, Whitney Houston. Definitely look into it. It is somebody that, you know, is a key role into, you know, the African-American music scene, especially for the female stars of yesteryear and today.
Yep. All right, folks, that is another edition of our Black History Triple Features for the month of February in the year of our Lord 2024. Next week's a fun one. Next week, we're going to be doing an actor focus, comedian focus. We're going to be looking at the at Richard Pryor, and we're going to review Car Wash, one of my favorite movies, Brewster's Millions, and The Toy with also late great comedian Jackie Gleason. So that'll be fun. The week after that, another one that's heavily music focused, Hustle and Flow, because it's hot out here being a pimp, as Jason Teasley will tell you. Black Snake Moan. Do you want to see an old black man chain up a white woman? Black Snake Moan is the movie for you. And and speaking of Richard Pryor, I prefer purple. We're going to look at The Wiz, which is the all-black version of The Wizard of Oz featuring Michael Jackson and I believe Diana Ross.
Yeah.
So that's a fun one. And then we're ending Black History Month with one that, like, Jason insisted that we do, just absolutely insisted, could not get away from this one, not at all, not even a little bit. We're looking at some parodies here, some comedies. Don't Be a Menace to Society While Drinking Your Juice in the Hood, I'm Gonna Get You Sucker, and How High. So that's what we got going on there. Jason, this is your second appearance this week on the Rattle of the Broadcasting Network. Him and Alexis talked to Percy Jackson and the Olympians, the new season one of the new Disney Plus show on Monday. Yesterday, Robert and I talked Argyle. Tomorrow, I will be doing a YouTube exclusive boxing coverage for the Teofimo Lopez fight on ESPN. Next week, in addition to Jason and I's triple feature, a whole bunch of us, including Jason, will be talking Lisa Frankenstein, on Damn You Hollywood. Wednesday, Alexis is reviewing Has Been Hotel. And then Thursday, I'm going to Machine Head Fuck Podcasting. All right. Jason Teasley, show us where you pissed from.
I mean, you've covered all my appearances, so that's where I piss from.
Okay. You're not doing anything with Mosaic Media?
Not currently. We're currently on hiatus. Work is constantly dragging us away, so we're on hiatus still yet. So, which I might watch the Twitter. I might actually be partnering with another podcast, if time allows, doing a nothing set in concrete yet. It's kind of Crayola'd in right now. Might be dropping a podcast this Friday for betting odds on the Super Bowl. I got a message today asking if I would be free, and may try to work something out. So watch my Twitter account, which is at Mosaic East Coast, Friday night to see if we drop that. If so, I will definitely link that. I will share it, and I will send it over to Mark and everyone here at the RIB to shoot out as well. If you want some betting odds for the Super Bowl this Sunday.
All right. For Jason Teasley, I'm Mark Rattledge. Thank you for celebrating us, celebrating Black History Month with us here, looking at these great women and their great movies. We're both still very tired. Be well, be safe, and behave.